British media say that calls for an end to the monarchy are grown stronger after the death of Queen Elizabeth. Russian troops regrouping in eastern Ukraine as Kyiv announces major territorial gains in several parts of Donetsk region. Millions of Muslim pilgrims heading for the Iraqi city of Karbala ahead of Erbain, a religious ritual to commemorate the third Shia Imam. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Calls are growing louder for an end to the British monarchy, with many starting to debate the relevance of the royal family since the death of Queen Elizabeth on Thursday. The main anti-monarchy group, Republic, says it's getting an influx of supporters on social media and elsewhere. The group says, however, many people are refraining from openly expressing their opinions, and that's because they do not want to cause offense amid the emotional atmosphere and media focus on the story. The Republic is instead inviting people to be vocal and not to feel intimidated. It says they have every right to speak their minds about monarchy as a public office. Following Queen Elizabeth's death, her eldest son Charles has been named king. His ascension to the throne was proclaimed at a ceremony on Saturday. Okay, from London, I'm now joined by Saeed Pourreza. Saeed, good to have you with us. So, tell us about these calls that are growing louder regarding actually questioning the relevance of the royal family and the monarchical system.
That's very true, Behrouz. These calls have been around for a long time. For one, you have a prime minister now in this country who, at one point in her career as a Republican, called for the monarchy to be abolished, and this goes back to the 1990s. She may have since changed her mind, but that's what she said back then. So did many other people. You're looking at a time when one in four Britons are now considering the monarchy as an anachronistic institution that has to be gone. Now that the queen, that was the figurehead of this institution for some 70 years, is gone, has passed away, and will be laid to rest on September 11th. If you look at the different age groups have different feelings and ideas of the monarchy. There are statistics out there, for example, saying that if you look at the younger generation, people between the ages of 18 and 24, they say they don't see the point of the monarchy, that it doesn't belong to the 21st century and it has to be done away with. But then over 65s seem to want the monarchy to stay around. So opinions are split, not just in the UK, but in other countries as well, in the so-called realms where the queen was now the king, Charles III, the head of state, such as Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and in the Commonwealth of Nations, so-called, that were formed when the late queen took power after her father's death in 1953. So those things are happening as we speak. If you look at or ask the nationalists or Republicans in Northern Ireland, who want reunification with the South, with the Republic of Ireland, and be part of the European Union, they would tell you that they want the monarchy to be gone as well. If you go to Scotland, the pro-independent Scots were asked last year, 2021, whether they would want the monarchy to be, or the monarch to be the head of state in the event of them gaining independence from the UK, and the answer was no. They didn't want that. They wanted Scotland to be a republic. And as I say, the outpouring of emotions, if you will, for the late monarch should not be mistaken for unwavering support for the monarchy itself, for the institution that the queen embodied for so many years. And let's not forget that the heir to the throne, the man that has inherited what is left of the former British Empire, or whatever that the Queen pieced together for so many years, is a much less popular monarch. And we can look at some of the reasons why, from his affair with now his wife and queen consort Kamala Parks Bowles, to his high-profile divorce from his wife, Princess Diana, who died in a car crash in France all those years ago, to in more recent days, allegations of racism in the monarchy, and the way his own son, Prince Harry, and his wife, Meghan Markle, were treated, the allegations against his brother, Prince Andrew, that rocked the monarchy yet again, over his associations with the convicted pedophile Jeffrey Epstein, and the settlement out of court with the victim, Virginia Giuffre, and question marks hanging over where that money came from. So, and this is again a monarch who has been revealed to have written those Black Spider memos between 2004 and 2005, trying to lobby government for all kinds of reasons, for a range of reasons. This is while the monarchy constitutionally is supposed to keep its nose out of politics. Having said that, again, going back to what the monarchy stood for, even in recent times when the Queen was still alive, it is, again, a refrain in the media that she was a beacon of stability and all those things, but and that she maintained impartiality and dedicated herself to service and duty for so many years. But it is not lost on the people that she also inherited a monarchy, an institution with blood on its hands in the past. And in recent decades, as you know, the prime minister in this country has weekly audiences with the monarch, and so she would have known and followed very closely what the British government was up to, and still went ahead to support some of the actions of the British government around the world over the past decades. She also proffered some of the highest awards and titles to leaders around the world and at home who are known to have blood on their hands. Mm-hmm. Starting here, Tony Blair, the former prime minister for the Iraq War, the illegal Iraq War, for in search of never-existing weapons of mass destruction. Right. Bush, the father, who said he wouldn't apologize for America after that downing of the Iranian passenger plane in the 1980s, and a list of other leaders, Henry Kissinger and the like. And so this is not a popular king at all internationally. He's already talked of downsizing the monarchy himself. But if anything, the future of the UK monarchy is uncertain, and uncertain only begins to describe it, Burism.
Okay, thank you so much for that. Syed Burism, my colleague in London. Now, almost 7 months into the war with Russia, Ukraine offensive to retake control of its territories gathering pace. Here's the Ukrainian president talking about the scale of his army's achievements.
The movement of our soldiers in different directions of the front continues. At present, about 2,000 square kilometers of our territory have been liberated in the framework of active operations since the beginning of September.
Zelensky claims that the Russian army is fleeing the area and says that there is no place for what it calls occupiers in his country. The foreign ministry also said that advances show Ukrainian forces are able to defeat the Russian army. It urged Western countries to continue to deliver weapons. Russia has confirmed the drawdown from eastern Kharkiv, but it says the troops in Balaklia and Izum regions are regrouping along the Donetsk front. Ukraine also says its troops are closing in on the eastern city of Lysychansk, which Russian forces captured 2 months ago. An offensive is also ongoing around the Russian-held Kherson region to south, with Moscow dispatching reinforcement there. Staying with Ukraine, operations of the Russian-controlled Zaporizhia nuclear power plant has come to a complete halt. State agency in charge of the facility says it's disconnected one of the power units at the site for safety purposes that led to a halt in operations of the power station. According to the agency, preparations are underway to cool down the plant. A few days ago, Kyiv asked local residents to evacuate Russia-held areas around the facility for their own safety. Russia and Ukraine accusing each other of risking a nuclear disaster by shelling the power station. The United Nations has called for the surrounding area to be demilitarized. A new report on poverty in France has revealed the devastating economic effects caused by Europe's sanctions on Russia. Over the Ukraine war, multiple indicators have reached record lows, showing that their lower classes are worse off in decades. Rami Mazaheder reports.
The annual report from one of France's top NGOs revealed that poverty has already skyrocketed this year. And that's at what many say is only the beginning of years of inflation and recession provoked by sanctions on Russia over the unrest in Ukraine. Secours Populaire found that the number of people who say they have known poverty has increased 9% in just the past year. That's the biggest increase in 30 years. This year, over 40% of France says they can't pay their transport, medical, energy, or childcare bills, or go on vacation, or even buy fruits and vegetables. It's the highest percentage they've ever recorded.
The poverty question in France is one that's been central, but the social safety net is running out. It's just going to get worse and worse for the poor people because they're not going to be able to afford this stuff, you know? And the French are not going to be able to subsidize these cost of living increases the way they did.
The steep increase in poverty comes after a decade of failed austerity policies and a deep devaluing of the euro currency. The government just announced they expect the next two economic quarters to produce a growth rate of 0.2% and then 0%. Many predict that the essentially recession-level economy will soon begin massive layoffs. That combination spells stagflation, and it's something for which liberal economics has no theoretical remedy. This adds to the feeling of unease, especially among the investor class and high finance.
France has a pretty good record of having a social safety net for those who are on bottom as far as health care is concerned and other basic necessities. But since Macron got elected, a lot of those things have changed because Macron has decided that he's going to attack that social safety net.
The report showed that a near universal 85% of France is worried for the future generations. That's also the highest percentage ever recorded. Ramin Mazaheri, Paris.
Millions of pilgrims from across the world converging on the Iraqi holy city of Karbala for the annual commemoration of Arbaeen. The pilgrims, many of them from Iran, are making the journey toward the city on foot. Karbala houses the shrine of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad. This year, the pilgrimage that's one of the largest religious congregations in the world reaches its peak on the 17th of September. Arbaeen marks 40 days after martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, and that day, the Imam and dozens of his companions were martyred during the Battle of Karbala some 14 centuries ago. Now, Sunday marks the 21st anniversary of the September 11 terrorist attacks in the U.S., the deadliest terrorist attack on American soil ever. Now, following the tragedy, the U.S. Invaded Afghanistan under the pretext that the Taliban supported Al-Qaeda. After 20 years, the Taliban are back in power and the country is reeling from multiple crises. We have a report from Kabul.
On September 11th, 2001, 19 terrorists hijacked four passenger jetliners and crashed them into major U.S. buildings. The attacks, killing nearly 3,000 people, were claimed by the Al-Qaeda terrorist group.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes.
The United States responded to the attacks by invading Afghanistan, despite the fact that no Afghan was involved in the attacks. In fact, the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in response to 9/11 attacks was totally wrong and against international law. Afghans were not involved in those attacks, and then al-Qaeda leader wasn't in Afghanistan. The U.S. occupied our country to achieve its geopolitical goals. It imposed a two-decade war on our country, but was finally defeated because our people stood against the oppressors and invaders.
The U.S. war in Afghanistan killed tens of thousands of people and displaced millions in the war-ravaged country. The American people lost trillions of dollars in their tax money, as well as thousands of army soldiers. Some experts say the only winner of the U.S. war were American defense contractors, who earned billions of dollars in revenue. According to those experts, the 9/11 attacks were a plot cooked and spied by Americans themselves to advance the Zionism agenda.
9/11 was a conspiracy rather than a real attack. By playing out this scenario, the Americans aimed to polarize the world again. The U.S. planned to fabricate a front fighting the Western world so that it can mobilize Western countries against that front and at the same time sell its weapons. One of the consequences of this incident was that the world after 9/11 became more ideological and that pitted the Islamic world against the West. What has been happening in the Middle East and Afghanistan for years are the consequences of September 11. The same conspiracy is currently running by provoking enmity against the U.S. and the West in Muslim countries in order to justify the invasion of countries in a region similar to Afghanistan.
The Taliban, which were ousted by the U.S.-led foreign troops in late 2001, came back to power in Afghanistan in August last year, after the U.S. forces left the country. Following the toppling of the Western-backed government in Kabul, the U.S. froze some $7 billion in Afghanistan's assets. Later, U.S. President Joe Biden signed an order authorizing the distribution of Afghan assets to 9/11 victims. Afghans and lawmakers denounced Biden's decision as an attempt to steal the Afghan people's money. 9/11 attacks in the U.S. resulted in years of destruction and bloodshed in Afghanistan. People here say they have been paying the price for attacks in which no Afghan was involved. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Allah, Allah, Allah. که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
Imam Hussein's decree is that every day is an Ashura and each territory's Karbala implies that his movement must be kept alive and active everywhere and at all times. This statement is our manual of action, just as Imam al-Hussein stood up and said no to the great empire. His decree must be repeated daily, and these morning sessions mean the perpetuation of the negation. Let our children and youth not consider this as a mourning matter. It is not that ours is the weeping nation. They, the enemies of Islam, fear these mourning sessions, for it is a cry in support of the oppressed. It is an outcry in opposition to tyrant.
A'udhu billah minash shaitanir rajim. We seek refuge from Satan the accursed, and in the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, we start another episode of the program, The Spring of Truth. Welcome to this program in which we try to reflect and contemplate and shed some light and paraphrase some of the sayings and valuable words of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, who is the founder of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Imam Khomeini held a very high position and status for women. You have to keep in mind that at the time that when Imam Khomeini came as a political and religious leader, women did not have a high position in the society. Many of them were locked inside their houses because of the belief of some backworded people that, you know, the women should totally be secluded to the home. They should have zero social presence in the society, and that, you know, they believe that the only place that you can possibly imagine is the home for a woman. Of course, being in the home and, you know, not being in the encounter of the non-mahrams is very good, but sometimes the needs of the society entail the participation, the active participation of the woman. For example, we need women teachers, we need women nurses, women doctors. You know, in certain places in the society, there are gaps which only have to be filled by women and not men. So we need to have educated women who attend universities, who graduate studies, who can help develop their society. But of course, this should not undermine the importance of the family and the fact that if there is the need for women to come to the society, the preservation of their hijab, their modesty, and the chastity of the society has to be of utmost importance.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi, sallallahu alayhi.
Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi, he says, men ascend to high heavens from the lap of the women. Elsewhere, he says, the woman is the only being that can deliver individuals to the society by whose blessings the society, nay, the entire societies, are drawn to endurance and lofty human values. The time of our program has come to an end. Thank you very much for being with us. Wa akhiru da'wana and alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Welcome back. In the first part of the Aperture, we witnessed various communities which have walled themselves in so that others may be kept out. In urban France, the middle class has increasingly retreated into gated communities. Likewise, in Rio de Janeiro, the middle class seeks to avoid the slums literally across the road from their gated condominiums. Stay with us for more as we explore the wall in Iraq, which American forces have constructed to cordon off the areas of Baghdad.
Abu Hazm's children go to school in Doura, within the walls that encircle the area. So, who wants the wall torn down? No one wants to keep it. What do you think will happen in the future? In Doura, our neighbourhood. Yes, Ali. I want more peace and no more walls and gardens. Sports clubs. Better education. So, less walls and more schools. I want to go to hospital without problems. How about you, Hauser? Take the walls away so I can get to the stadium easily. Tell me, what do you think when you see the walls? We're enclosed. It's like prison. I've tried to reassure them about the future. We talk about it, of their vision, and we all hope things will work out. Life doesn't stand still, it evolves. In the areas closest to the walls, the locals are particularly angry. Look, it's a prison. To go to the market, I need to take a taxi. And another one to come back. And the market is only a few steps away, behind the wall. And during school, it's even worse. The kids get all muddy. Okay, I know they want to stop the terrorists, but they could take away two pieces of the wall to make our lives a bit easier. It really affects us. Like from dawn till dusk, all we see is this wall. We all know each other here. We all have different religions, but there are no problems. Yeah, the wall drives me nuts. Look at my legs, I'm sick, and I don't have a car to get there. How am I meant to go to hospital? We're all depressed. Put yourself in our place. If you woke up and had this wall right in front of you every day, what would you do? Tell me. In February 2011, Iraqi demonstrators take part in the Arab Spring. They protest having to live walled up. In the weeks that follow the demonstrations, the government will organize a large-scale communications campaign. The Ministry of Interior takes two busloads of journalists to the areas once held by the insurgents, and now completely walled off. Good morning, sir. Now, would it help you if we remove some parts of the wall? Oh, yes, sir. The wall was very harmful to us, but it also brought you safety. Well, to begin with, yes, but that's all over now. So what would you like then? Leave the wall or take it away? Take it away, please. Where will we put it? Wherever you like. The next morning, it's back to the same area to see if the work is continuing. The crane has disappeared. Just the residents remain, as angry as ever. They never tell the truth. They promised the wall would be gone in a week. Nothing's changed. They say yes, 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 today for sure. And then they come back 2 years later. They built this wall as a barrier between my neighbors and myself. They should take it down and put it on the border with Saudi Arabia. They should have police patrols, not walls. In our brave new world, The differences between military and civilian security technology are becoming blurred. What the army invents to protect its own bases, gated communities adopt for the benefit of individuals.
So when the arm goes down, the teeth come up automatically. That way, if a vehicle tries to ram through the arm, they're going to shred their tires.
Now you have digital zoom while recording the entire area, so you're not losing any video coverage while tracking a person or an automobile that might be coming onto your property.
And present a card. And then this sends the data stream to an access controller, so you can select when someone can get in and when they can get out.
We can put our software, it can be loaded on a smartphone. So if there's a violation at the north gate coming into the gated community, the guard can get an alert on his smartphone with the video clip.
There's like an integration of military materials and civilian materials in terms of security nowadays.
Correct. For residential use, it's just a lighter duty machine, as opposed for things that are built specifically for military or border operations. They have to be much heavier duty.
Thais's mother wants to buy an apartment in this condominium that is even more luxurious than their own. But it's even further from the center of Rio. Regis lives on the other side of the railings, just a few meters away, but has never stepped foot inside.
Do you have any friends inside?
Very few. Well, actually, none. I don't know anyone. But, you know, I don't want to climb the wall that encircles them. I'm not interested in that. I'm just not curious about what it's like inside. I know the kind of person that lives there. My boss, for example. I've never been to his house, but I've got a pretty good idea what it's like. White shirt, yellow tie. Security is very polite. And they don't miss a thing. It's like a labyrinth, a maze. You go in one side and out the other. At least there is an exit. Regis might have said no, but passing the splendid houses every day, he does dream of winning the lottery. Yeah, of course, I'd buy myself a beautiful place. A manor even, with a football pitch, a pool, barbecue. And what about security? I don't know if I'd have any. Maybe a camera. And a pit bull. Compared to the favelas in Rio, the Mirai housing estates are havens of tranquility. Hey, no scooters here. It's no good. There are people who live here. And it's not good for the kids. Go on, guys. All they have in common is the absence of the state. When his neighborhood became dangerous for the public services, Zubir spoke to the housing administration about controlling the rowdier elements. The mediator's method is to be firm, but not unpleasant. And there's a place available until midnight for the kids who have nowhere else to go. In the past, it was the community police that did this kind of work. Jean-Pierre Avrin used to be the head of the Toulouse police. He's now left the national force and is working for the municipal police. He'd set up a community policing project in the housing estates of Mirai. The video is barely 10 years old, but is now almost historic, certainly unusual. Relaxed-looking police in shirt sleeves in Mirai. The police should not be cut off from the people. It won't be effective. The police have to be close to the citizens. It's the only way to make it work. I think the community police I knew was well liked by the residents. They used to call the youngsters by their first names. And instead of fining them something straight away, they'd say, "Oh, if you could move your car, please, that would be great." They spoke to the kids, and the kids would shake their hands. Now, if you shake a policeman's hands, you'd be considered an informer. Nicolas Sarkozy puts an end to community policing when he is the Interior Minister in 2003. He summons Avrin and his men before the cameras to let them know he's not pleased by their results. There are many of you where the delinquents are.
Vous n'êtes pas des travailleurs sociaux.
You're not social workers. The principal mission of the police is to investigate, arrest, and fight criminal behavior. When I look at the statistics of 2001, 2002 are bad enough, but 2001, to humiliate police officers live in front of the cameras, I had never seen anything like that before. For those who were present, for the policemen, those who were involved for 4 years, to tell them like that, it was a disgrace, disloyal. In the 3 years after the disbanding of the community police, the incidence of violent crime increased by 48% in Mireille. And the rioting witnessed throughout France in 2005 ravages the neighborhood. If they venture into Mireille these days, the police come in body armor. The area is tough, and not just for the police. The nurses don't come as often, neither do the firemen, and the ambulances have stopped coming altogether. It sort of became abandoned because they were scared about being ambushed by the youngsters. Not to mention the police. To them, they are the state. So people no longer support the state. Well, let's say they don't trust the state anymore. In the 7 days spent on the estates, we only spotted one police car, and that was a long way off. After saying we could interview them, the Toulouse police changed their minds. In 3 years, the National Police Force has been cut by 11,000. You can't claim that security is a priority if you cut thousands of police jobs. There was a sharp increase in the number of cars burned, physical attacks, the absence of police on the ground, especially in the more difficult zones. As soon as authority is absent, especially the police, it's like nature, which can't stand vacuum. It creates a replacement authority, which may differ depending on the area or circumstances. I was summoned before senior police officers, and they said, so what's all this about them? Is it a militia? Everyone's talking about it. They felt threatened by it. It bothered them. Calling us a militia. A militia with no weapons. If you want to call us a militia without weapons. Our weapons are words. That's it, really. It's a small aperitif in the open air. Here we are then. We said we wouldn't make too much noise so as not to be a nuisance. After that, we said, well, you had better leave. Take your bottles and leave. And don't leave bottles lying around here because they get broken and that could cause a lot of damage. The difference is that if a policeman comes to check us, he might smile, but he's stressed. I don't know if he lives out in the countryside and then comes here, but it's better when people who grew up around here and who know what it's all about and who's who, they sort of understand all of that. We're here to stay with them. Sort it out peacefully, quietly, like. We're getting ready, it seems, to allow private security firms to take over some of the work on public property, say, which is a terrible mistake, because all it will do is aggravate the differences between the haves and the haves-not. A two-speed security, in other words. There'll inevitably be one sort of security for the rich and another for the poor, to put it simply. The Rocinha Favela in Rio. The city's prefect is about to inaugurate a brand new health center in the middle of the favela. The drug traffickers are invisible. The prefect has come without an armed escort. We're going to urbanize all the favelas in the city by 2020. All of them. Rocinha will change. There'll be peace. And listen well, I mean peace. The governor will be responsible. Everyone has a right to live and live in good health. Here's a plaque, so applause now. For President Lula's Brazil, the fight against crime means investing in the public services. The people know it, and so do the thugs. The party's over here. At the same time, we need health and education programs, more daycare, more buildings, and to change the urban policies. All that will transform people's lives. Itamar Silva has lived his entire life in a favela and was one of the first to benefit from state aid. He's a respected intellectual and a man who is angry. In his view, more than public funds will be needed to tear down the walls which separate the rich and the poor in Brazil. The investment we're seeing today in the favelas is only very recent. It's considered dangerous, a place that needs supervision, otherwise we'll all become criminals. What I say, it's not true. If it was true, there would have been a revolution a long time ago. Yes, unfortunately, because that's what we need to happen. In the evening, there's a big party in Rocinha. A new street has been opened. The government has demolished some hovels and built a sort of avenue whose buildings match the acrobatic and multicolored style of the favelas. Another reason to party. The drug traffickers have hung up their weapons and made way for samba. In the background are the condominios, over which night is falling in complete safety. Tell me, wouldn't you be better off in a condominium? Listen, I've been here 50 years and I'm not budging. It's marvelous up here. But you don't want to be safer? Ah, it's very safe here. Anyone can come here and everyone is welcome. No problems.
Speaking of walls, perhaps we can mention more walls which are undermining regional and world peace. The segregation wall built by the Zionist regime of Israel in the West Bank, Palestine. And the recent wall in Hungary, built to keep out asylum seekers trying to reach Europe. And that's it for this week on Aperture. Until next week and another episode of Aperture, goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, dear brothers and sisters, Salamun alaikum, welcome to this episode of Lantern. Now, on the continuation of this program, Lantern, we have a nice story. Let's listen to it. The title of today's story on this program, Lantern, is Don't Change the World. Once upon a time, there was a king who ruled a prosperous country. One day he went for a trip to some distant areas of his country. When he was back to his palace, he complained that his feet were very painful because it was the first time that he went for such a long trip. And the road that he went through was very rough and stony. He then ordered his people to cover every road of entire country with leather. Definitely, this would need thousands of cows' skin and would cost a huge amount of money. Then one of his wise servants dared himself to tell the king, "Why do you have to spend that unnecessary amount of money? Why don't you just cut a little piece of leather to cover your feet?" The king was surprised, but he later agreed to his suggestion to make a shoe for himself. There is actually a valuable lesson of life in this story. To make this world a happy place to live, you better change yourself, your heart, and not the world. Now, on the continuation of this program, Lantern, we'll listen to the scholar's note on this story. Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa binastain. In this episode, we are going to be concerned with making a change in ourselves in order to experience a better life. Some people might expect that something like a magic should come down from the heaven in order to make a change, a great positive change in their lives. Such an expectation is really illogical and quite irrational. From this perspective, it must be indicated that those people who want a great change to happen to them, I mean, ab initio, without any background, there must be some people who seldom believe that one of the great causes of making a positive change in one's own life is the individual himself. Apart from those accounts indicated in the Holy Quran, we find that, for example, in Islamic history or in the history of Muslim lands, you find that whatever people wanted to make any significant and great and positive change, they were successful. Of course, there's another condition in this regard. When people individually may want to get out of a certain problem or a series of, problems, and not individually, but socially speaking, there's a social appeal or a social desire for that great change. There's another condition. There must be a reliable leader, a reliable, or in a better sense, a charismatic leader. Please note well that, for example, in the case of the third infallible Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the companions of Imam al-Hussein al-Islam, they wanted to make that great change in the political situation, in the religio-political situation of the Muslim community. Well, they got together and they supported Imam al-Hussein al-Islam. Since they supported Imam al-Hussein al-Islam, and Imam al-Hussein al-Islam was a really great figure, whose divinely given knowledge wasn't at issue at all. I mean, it wasn't, and there was no question regarding the knowledge and guidance of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. They wanted to make a great change. However, since a greater majority of those people who were apparently Muslims and they were residents in Kufa, they supported the Umayyad dynasty. All in all, the whole movement proved futile. It means that, a greater social desire should be over there.
Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we look at the story, which indicates a moral aspect of our life.
At the same time, we find that, for example, in the case of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, where people, right in the final years of the ex-Shah period, we find that when people were really tired of the miscalculations and mispolicies of the Shah dynasty and the Shah regime, and people wanted to have a great change, a significant, great, and historic change in their lives. Plus, they had such a leader, such a charismatic leader like Imam Khomeini. This revolution, proved quite successful. And it means that in addition to, individual desire and social appeal, there must be a good and reliable and certainly very influential leadership over there. Another case is that people are apt to make mistakes or apt to commit some sins from time to time because we are all human beings. We are, whether we want or not, we are under the influence of Satan. Satan is very powerful. Although we've been instructed to oppose satanic temptations, however, in some cases, people make mistakes, and this is a reality. Yet, those people who make mistakes are permitted to come back to the right path. The Holy Quran is explicit in this regard. It says, فَأَمَّا مَنْ تَابَ وَآمَنَ وَعَمِلَ صَالِحًا فَعَسَى أَنْ يَكُونَ مِنَ الْمُفْلِحِينَ. And those people who repent and have faith in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and do good, they compensate whatever they failed to do. فَعَسَىٰ أَن يَكُونَ مِنَ الْمُفْلِحِينَ. Perhaps they may be among those people who reach felicity. So we find that those people who make mistakes or who commit sins that are given the opportunity to come back to the right path and not to make sins again, not to commit those sins again. From this perspective, we find that, repentance receives its significance in Islamic instructions. According to Islamic instructions, repentance means that, individually speaking, at the individual level, each and every person decides not to commit any sin or not to make those mistakes. And socially speaking, the whole community decides to be on the right track. Thank you.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ana bi dhikrillahi tatma'innu al-qulub.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.